Welcome to the MedTech Talent Lab, the number one catalyst for advancing careers and building high-performance teams. Sponsored by the Anthony Michael Group, helping companies secure in-demand talent in regulatory affairs, quality, clinical, engineering, R&D, and other areas for medical device, digital health, diagnostics, and other organizations across the U.S. life sciences sector. Here's your host, Mitch Robbins.
Hey, welcome back to another episode here on the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. I'm your host, Mitch Robbins, founder and managing director at the Anthony Michael Group, building teams and careers across the industry. And today I have the pleasure of sitting down with Mr. Mickey Brown, who is the Vice President of Access and Reimbursement at Serapeutics. Mickey comes to the show today with over 30 years experience in the industry, serving across lines on both the payer side and the manufacturing side. He's worked for companies like Blue Cross, Medtronic, and Cochlear, to name a few. And today he leads all of market access and reimbursement efforts for Serapeutics. And if you aren't familiar with Serapeutics, the company is a global commercial stage orthobiologics organization that aspires to transform the standard of care for bone repair, helping bones heal faster and at higher rates without compromising safety. So without further ado, Mickey, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, I am thrilled that you're here. We've had some offline conversations and you're just an overall good guy. We both live here in Colorado. We're both dealing with the viruses that are going on around town for our families. So, but we made it. We're here together to talk about all things career pertaining to you specifically. And Mickey, how I like to start off these shows is to recognize that the only reason you're standing where you are today is because of the history that's helped kind of shape your experience and shape your life. And prior to the professional piece, I think it's really vital and intriguing to kind of go back to your formative years and understand your foundation. So if you would, tell us about your formative years, home life, where you grew up, family, things like that.
Sure. Yeah, so I grew up in Jackson, Mississippi area, a small town called Madison, which is just north of Jackson, suburb community. Pretty normal childhood. Went to local schools there. Played soccer, was my sport of choice. Soccer and cross country were the two things that I really enjoyed. Mostly soccer, with cross country as a training tool to be able to do all the running in soccer. Played throughout high school and through college. Met my wife my freshman year of college. We've been married for 34 years. Hope she doesn't watch this, because then she's.
I was just gonna say, get it right, Mickey.
30 plus years. We'll just go with that.
There you go.
Yeah, and my parents still live in Mississippi, so go back occasionally to visit. I have four daughters, all adults, and two grandchildren, and so it's sort of enjoying that grandparent lifestyle now, which is far superior to the parenting lifestyle. Let me tell you.
That is awesome, and I see it through my own parents with my kids. And
yes,
it is a different thing.
It absolutely
it's a different thing when you've got all of the joy and none of the responsibility, so to speak.
That's right. So after high school, I went to a small college in Jackson, Mississippi called Millsaps College. Millsaps is a liberal arts college, Methodist school. Played soccer there, and as I said, I met my wife. My major was history. I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life. I thought for a while that I wanted to be a soccer coach. And then I realized you could do that without actually doing it for a living. And so I chose that route. So I did some travel team coaching for a few years after college until we started having our own family. And I was fortunate when I was leaving school to get a job with Blue Cross of Mississippi. There weren't a lot. I mean, 1991 was the year and the jobs market was tight, particularly for a guy who had no particular specialty or skill set. So I went to work for Blue Cross, worked my way up there, found I had interest in managed care and sort of managed care in Mississippi. And in a lot of parts of the country, it was sort of a fledgling idea, more mature in certain markets, but certainly in the South, it was not a big offering from health plans. We still had the traditional Many of the folks that'll view this or listen to this podcast won't remember the good old days, but it was deductible and coinsurance. There were no networks. Life was good. And we moved into managed care. So I was involved in sort of that trend there at Blue Cross. I worked there for 5 or 6 years, left, went to United Healthcare and to a small hospital owned HMO, which was a really good experience, sort of to get a different sort of view of healthcare, how a large publicly traded company works, how a small company that's a fledgling company works. So that was a really good experience. But ultimately, Blue Cross called me back to do a special project for them, which was a great opportunity. It was to build a network for state and school employees. And in doing that, I got to meet with state legislators, state regulators, all of the big specialty societies in the state, the biggest hospitals. And I had 6 months to build a network. Ultimately, we were successful, not without a lot of angst and sleepless nights, but we got it done. But that was a really good experience for me, I think, sort of entrepreneurial spirit inside the protection of a larger organization.
Let me stop you there. I want to leave a teaser. Before we go on, you mentioned your home life, cross country, soccer. Yeah. You went to school in Mississippi. You cut your teeth at Blue Cross. Do you have siblings or are you an only child?
I have siblings. I have a split family. My parents divorced when I was very young. And so I have a number of brothers and sisters. I have, my mother has two boys and a stepson. My father has a son and daughter. And then I have one sister from my parents' original marriage. So lots of siblings. So I wasn't the Lone Ranger. I wasn't a single parent. I mean, a single child. I was quite, typically the sort of the middle child, right? I wasn't the adventurous one. That was my sister, the older, and then I wasn't a troublemaker. Not that really any of my siblings fit in the troublemaker category. We didn't really have that sort of traditional troublemaker child that I can remember. Maybe I blocked all that after all these years. Maybe it was me and I just don't know it. But
the point is, it sounds like you were surrounded by a pretty big family.
Yeah, big family. With the challenges of parents that are divorced and, having to, shuttle back and forth for holidays and, sort of re-engage with family members that you haven't seen for a while. But my parents worked really hard at it to make it, as comfortable as possible. Although that's always challenging, right? I'm not gonna suggest that my life as a child was hard in any way, but there were parts of it that were a little tougher than others, and that was certainly part of it. Yeah.
And my heart goes out to you as a child like that. My kids, I'm divorced, and my kids are experiencing it right now, and I understand it. Yeah. Kind of breaks my heart every couple days when they go back and forth.
It's tough, right? The gear shift is different, right? You gotta reacclimate to a new family structure, a new family dynamic, and you just left one, and right, so you're constantly moving back and forth. But again, my parents worked hard to try to do that as best as they could. We never treated any of the siblings have never treated each other as sort of half or step or whatever the prefix is for that. So everybody worked hard to just, understand that this is a little different than maybe some other people. But also, I'm 55 years old. So I was growing up in a period of time where where divorce was happening to a lot of families. That was sort of the wave of divorce being sort of a more common thing. It was a little more rare before I came along. So I knew lots of kids that were like me, right? That one holiday here, yeah, one holiday there. And so that helped, right? Because you knew people who were in the same situation and, there were similar challenges for them. So I didn't feel any different than anybody else, I guess was a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And then as your career kind of progressed, you're at Blue Cross. How did you end up on the industry side, working for manufacturing?
I was on the health plan side for about 15 years. And it was one of those days where I was just having a tough day. I mean, I was pretty happy at Blue Cross. I felt like I was doing good work. You know, I felt like I worked for Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Mississippi, and our tagline was, you know, essentially a healthier Mississippi. And we were instituting a lot of programs to try to drive that. And I really felt invested in that work, but I was having a bad day. I don't even remember what the issue was. And I was pretty unhappy that particular day, and a recruiter called me, and I had not taken recruiter calls for years. Cause I enjoyed what I was doing. And I took a call one day, and the recruiter was working for Medtronic. And I said, well, I'm only interested in roles in the Southeast because that's where my family is. And that's what I want to do. And she said, well, good news. This one's in Memphis, Tennessee, which is, you know, 3.5 hour drive from Jackson, Mississippi. I was like, well, this sounds good. So I took the call. I got an interview. Medtronic was looking for someone that understood how payers think. They were going to launch some new technologies that they thought might encounter some challenges, and wanted somebody who better understood the intricacies and the ins and outs of health plans and how they work. I was like, well, I can do that. I've done that for 15 years. So I made the jump, moved the family to Memphis, the Memphis area. So not too far, but far enough. We had lived in the Jackson area our whole married life, and I had never lived anywhere else. And so that was, while it wasn't a long way, it was a difference. And I think a good difference for me, because you sort of, you know, you got to make new friends. You've got to find new things to do and organizations to be part of and things like that. And I think it was good for my kids because they, you know, were in small schools, went to bigger schools, had to interact with new people and different people. And so that was good for them. What was interesting is Hurricane Katrina hit the weekend before I was supposed to start work in Memphis. And so we didn't have power. We didn't have gasoline. I spent the Sunday before I left driving around trying to find gasoline because there wasn't any in town. I finally found it, filled up tanks and cars and, you know, told my wife goodbye, and I drove up and she stayed. Fortunately, our house wasn't damaged. We were far enough from the center of it all, that things got pretty back to normal pretty quickly in the Jackson area. But I, you know, it was sort of, you know, a nervous time for me. And I went up there, and I would come back on weekends until my kids finished their first semester of school. And then we transferred them the second semester up. So that was, but I think that was a good thing for me, right? You're leaving your support network, you're leaving, you know, health plan side of things that's all you've known in your professional career. That was all good for me from a growth and development standpoint, I think.
That's awesome. And, you know, as a leader now, fast forward, you're leading the whole program. Do you see it as a benefit for people who want to get into market access reimbursement, you know, working for the manufacturer? Do you see it as a benefit coming from the health plan the same way they did way back when, or not necessarily?
I mean, I think it's, you know, having that background is good, right? I mean, you, in fact, probably being newer to, you know, a newer convert from health plans would be more helpful than my experience. My experience is now 15 years old. And we've had a bunch of health plan consolidations. We've had a bunch of changes in healthcare. Not in the way people had hoped, I think, but we've had a lot of changes in healthcare. So being closer to it might be helpful to somebody sort of entering this side of things. And the things that manufacturers need are the things that they needed when I joined, right? Understanding how is this technology going to be viewed by payers so that I can have my best foot forward when I bring this product to market. And, you know, interestingly, in my opinion, many manufacturers wait too long to start thinking about it, right? So they've got a great idea. They should almost think about it in that before you start your clinical study, before you start things like that, you should have a viewpoint on when it gets to market, what's the challenge going to be? And some of that's leading the target, right? Because the world changes, right? It doesn't sit stagnant, and the payers evaluate and view technologies differently over time. So you do have to have somebody who can sort of think ahead and lead the target as best you can. But to your question, yeah, I think there's value in having somebody who could make that shift. Now, not every role, right? I mean, you wouldn't want somebody who managed a claims operation to take a role. That's probably not so beneficial. But somebody who led a medical policy team, somebody that dealt with those sorts of things, and even on the reimbursement side, you know, some of the new and evolving reimbursement models that are out there, that would be helpful to manufacturers as well.
Do you think that not starting early enough with your reimbursement strategy and market access strategy, do you think that is the number one mistake that organizations make when it comes to your world of expertise, or do you think it's something different?
I think that is probably one, number one mistake that's made. It's not a tragic mistake. I mean, you can come back from it, but it makes things much longer. You know, I think the commitment to continued clinical data development, right? I did one clinical study that should be adequate for payers. It generally is not. And so sort of, okay, I'm going to finish this study. What's the next study? And sort of building out, how am I going to continue to prove to payers that this product is what is one that they should cover? And I think a lot of times people think, oh, one clinical study, I'm done. And it's generally speaking, that's not true. And coupled closely with that is sort of unrealistic expectation of how quickly payers are going to cover your technology. Yeah. It's typically 5 to 7 years, depending on what it is. You know, if you cure cancer, it would be immediate, but nobody's curing cancer. You know, there's a few products that have come out in the last couple of years that were really, really game changers. And payers can quickly see the value and they get approved quickly. Things that are harder to tease out from a payer's view, what's the value of the technology? Those are the ones that need to continue investing in studies and things. So I think having it early so you can at least voice that input of, okay, we've got one clinical study. We've laid out the endpoints we think we're going to need, but what's after that? How are we going to continue to prove that out as we go down this path? And having a plan of a realistic plan are the critical components, I think.
It's got to be a lot of guts on behalf of the manufacturer and the investors to not get the coverage that they're looking for yet. They've got good clinical data, but they need more clinical data, and to keep investing, keep putting forth time and effort, you've got to have a ton of confidence, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, I get this question a lot at all the places I've ever been. What do payers want? And my comedic comeback is what you don't have. So they want an RCT. Well, you've got an RCT. Well, now we want two. Well, if you did two, now we want real world evidence. Well, you get that, and then we want, you know, something else, right? It's a lot of times a moving bar, and each payer can have a sort of a different viewpoint, right? There's not one central clearinghouse for payer coverage, right? It's each payer individually. And so you do kind of have to think through that. Like, my favorite phrase is, so what? So I'm meeting with teams of people and they're saying, well, our product does this. And I say, so what? And I'm not saying it to be mean. I'm saying that's what the payer's going to ask. Like, you need to translate it into the value to them, right? So superior patient outcomes is a clear, easy one, right? But when you started getting into the sort of the sub, you know, shorter OR time, shorter, earlier return to work, you know, it's prove it to me, you know, everybody turns into Missouri, the show me state, right? They all want to, you know, I'm not going to believe you just because you told me you're going to have to prove it to me. So I think you have to be really critical, internally, and, you know, you need to be your own biggest critic as you're sort of rolling out to introduce the product to the market. Right. Don't assume that, you know, because the engineer says it's amazing, that everybody's going to view it that way, particularly from the purchasing perspective.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. What about, you know, here we are in 2025, and I think about the course of your career, you've seen so much evolve over the last 30 plus years or so. What's the biggest challenge for market access and reimbursement leaders here in 2025?
Wow. So when I started in this side of the industry in 2005, I won't say it was easy to get a meeting with a payer, but you could get meetings with payers. You could sit down with them. You could present data. You could bring a physician with you and them talk about the what they see from a patient need standpoint. You could have those engagements. It's gotten really hard to get a meeting. Everybody wants you to just send your data. So you don't have any discussion. You don't get any feedback in terms of, if they're not going to cover your product, what are the gaps that they see? It's really hard to get that feedback. I actually did one of these meetings last week, which was surprising, but we did it through a pretty circuitous route. We actually went through our employee health plan broker to get the meeting with the payer. It was not, we're a manufacturer, we want to talk to a payer. It was as the insured group, we went through our broker and we got a meeting, and it was a good meeting. But it was not easy. And I'm right in the middle right now of engaging three or four different payers trying to get meetings. And the answer so far has been schedules are too full. And I think one of the things that's happened is in 2005, people like me were pretty rare. The big companies had them, little companies didn't. Now everybody, I say everybody, most companies have somebody like me reaching out to payers. And so if I were a payer, I would be pushing, but like, I don't have time in the day to meet with every manufacturer that's out there. Right. So that's gotten problematic. And then COVID, you know, is the great excuse for a lot of things. But it has made getting in-person meetings really hard. It got easy for them to say no to that. And, you know, video conference. So the ones that we have now, the few that we've been able to engage are all video conference, and nobody turns their camera on. So you don't know whether they're engaged or not engaged. So it's gotten really tough. That's not to say you shouldn't do it and you shouldn't try, and that there aren't ways like going through your broker to get meetings. But the good old days of just calling and them saying, yes, come on. Or the other strategy that we employed a lot was really just wind up a doctor who really believes in the technology and thinks it's best for patients, wind them up, prepare them, and have them contact their local payer. They could get a meeting. That's gotten hard. Nobody wants to meet anymore. So that's made it difficult, I think.
So a lot to unpack there. In the first place I go is, since this United Healthcare thing happened with the shooting, have you seen an immediate change with response from payers as far as trying to, you know, hide maybe some of their medical directors or executives internal? Like, have they made it harder since then? Have you noticed?
You know, so in the last couple of weeks, I've been researching a couple of payers that we're trying to engage, and they don't have much LinkedIn presence. I don't know whether they did before or not. My suspicion is those that were on LinkedIn are off now. Those that weren't, you know, aren't coming on. I don't know that it's made it harder to connect with payers. I can tell you the engagement that I had the other day. They seemed much more engaged than the last time I spoke to this particular payer. That I was able to do the same thing through my last employer, use my broker to get a meeting. Not the same exact people, but same organization. And I can tell you, they seemed more engaged, more friendly, more interested. Now, that could be totally a coincidence. It could be that it's a different group of people, and so maybe they were. But I didn't get and this was a big payer. This is a national. I don't want to drop names, but this is a national payer. I didn't get the "we're big, you're small, leave us alone" feeling that I got last time that I talked to them. So I'm hoping that's a trend that we'll see. Look, I want to state for the record, that man should not have lost his life over the challenges that people are having with health insurers and dealing with claims and issues, right? I mean, that's absolutely the wrong way that we should go about trying to drive change. But it does seem to, based on this one interaction, maybe have had some change in the positive direction. And that, you know, my hope is that not the killing itself, but sort of the reaction. And you know, if you go on any social media platform these days, you're hearing more and more horror stories. I'm sure some are made up, but I'm guessing most are real. And my hope is that payers are hearing that too and saying, look, we've got to work on this. The other thing that was interesting, the other day, a group of shareholders filed some sort of request to United Healthcare asking for a report on how denials are affecting their image and the stock itself. And so, you know, once the shareholders start asking those sorts of questions, will we see some real change and some real openness? My hope is yes.
I sure hope so as well. And then I was thinking about being in your position and not being able to get these meetings and having to rely on blindly sending your data and hoping that somebody, you know, sees enough to say, yeah, okay, let's talk. And the pressure that someone like yourself must feel that you've got a job to do, and your job is to move things forward and gain access, gain coverage. You've got an executive team who's counting on you saying, what is going on? Let's go, let's go. You're being faced with stonewalling. How do you handle that?
Well, you know, so what I generally tell my employees is, you know, we can't guarantee an outcome. I mean, we don't own the payers. We can try to understand their viewpoint and provide them as much as we can. We can't own, you know, the outcome is not something we can control. We can control the effort, and we can control, okay, they said no. All right, what's the next approach? And what's the next approach? And so, you know, I think, you know, with my leadership team at Serapeutics, what we try to do is show that, look, we're doing the right things. And if we continue to do the right things, good things will happen, right? I mean, because you can't. I mean, there's not a formula that says, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. And if we do 1 + 1, we'll always get 2. It just doesn't work that way. And so what you have to do is rather than say, you know, oh, payer said no, I give up. I mean, you keep going, you keep trying, you keep saying, you inform. You know, so what I do is I work with our clinical team and say, look, they're telling me we don't have enough evidence. We have one RCT. It's like, well, what else can we do? Can we collect real world evidence? Can we do a retrospective study and start thinking strategically there to say, okay, I mean, no is not no forever. How do we change that no to a yes? Probably a lot like the sales cycle, right? You know, right. Just because the doctor says no doesn't mean you don't go see him again.
100%. And I think that what you're saying too is, yeah, it's much, much harder, but people buy based on the value that they see, right? And people like to buy, they don't like to be sold. That's how sales works. And so in the sales world with the doctor, you got to demonstrate enough value as how it's going to help them help their patients. Same thing here. It's like, if you make the payer's life a little bit easier somehow by giving them the evidence that they need to make the justification on their end, everybody's lives become easier. But I can imagine it's got to be very, very frustrating more often than not, banging your head against the wall or trying to at least get the communication going.
Yeah, and it can be frustrating. And sort of the other frustration is a lot of times you need surgeon demand. Like, you know, I mentioned winding the doctor up and sending him in the room. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a lot of physicians saying, I need access to this for this patient for this reason. And, you know, if you go to a payer, you're lucky enough to get a meeting and they tell you, well, we don't get any appeals, so our policy must be correct. That's the worst feeling in the world, because that means that your customer base is either not sold or willing to put the effort in to try to help you drive to a coverage decision. And so there's a bit of top down, bottom up strategy where you attack the payer from attack's probably not the right word, but you approach the payer from the industry perspective. But then you need grassroots demand for the product. You need physicians calling to pre-cert, and if they get denied, doing appeals saying this is why this patient needs the technology, and so that you're sort of pushing the payer from two directions. And so you do have to work collaboratively with your sales team, right? If the sales team is telling you, look, I can't sell it because we're not getting approvals, then you need to be back in with the sales force saying, well, can we get some people to submit appeals? Because appeals cost payers money, yep. Right? And if you can get them spending enough money on appeals, and if they're losing those appeals at external review or other places, then they're more likely to change their policy. But if they're never hearing about your technology from anybody, why change the policy? I mean, it's, you know, it's a tree that falls in the woods with no one around. Right? It makes no sound. I mean, you need that noise from the market. So you have to do a bit of driving from both ends.
I've got a double-edged question for you. One is about your own career and your leadership. And the other one is about leading people. And we're going to start with your own career. You know, you've held some pretty significant roles over the years. I mentioned you had some great exposure at Medtronic. You were leading the program for Cochlear, or at least a huge part of it, from what I know. You've done it, you know, kind of in the startup, small organization world. Can you point out pivotal moments in your career that you think helped catalyze your career and kind of help you get to the next level?
So I think, you know, the first thing that I did is when I was at Blue Cross, my first job there, I was a medical underwriter. So they had me reviewing people's medical history to decide whether they got insurance or not. This is before HIPAA. So we could review individual medical history and we could say yes or no to whether we cover you or not. Why I was qualified for that, I have no idea. I mean, I was a history major, medical history. Maybe somebody got confused, but they stuck me in that job. No medical training at all. And it was the most miserable job I've ever had because you had to actually tell people they couldn't have health insurance. And people were very upset. People would cry. You could understand, right? I would have nightmares about the phone ringing and having to talk to people about that as a 22-year-old. Pretty tough job. But Blue Cross posted a position for their managed care coordinator, and I applied for it. So here's the pivotal point. They told me that I had to do a presentation to a group of executives as part of the application process. And I was petrified. I wanted to pull my application from the job. And my better half, my wife, coached me up and convinced me to keep my hat in the ring. I put together a presentation. She helped me. This is back before PowerPoint was a big thing. She was the PowerPoint guru. She helped me put together a presentation. And we really, as a team, she helped prepare me for this interview. Did the interview, did the presentation, got the job. So now I presented to an executive team successfully. So you get a little bit of confidence, right? You taking those small opportunities, at the time it seemed big, but in hindsight, small opportunities to present yourself in a good light to an organization, to organizational leadership, but also to sort of stretch your comfort and your self-imposed boundaries, right? To say, no, you can do this. So once I did that, I was like, okay, you know, I feel like I do a lot of things now all of a sudden that I wasn't maybe so sure that I could do. So that was one. I left Blue Cross and went to the Mississippi Hospital Association, and they had created an HMO. They had 15 hospital members, and they were going to build out an HMO, and I was going to be one of the first employees. And my first day on the job, I had just completed my onboarding paperwork. They took me to a meeting, sat me in front of a hospital administrator who had a bunch of questions about what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And they basically said, this is Mickey. He can answer all your questions day one. So again, you're just sort of shoved into it and think or swim. And fortunately, I swam. That's the right word. But again, that's you're sort of a person who runs a big hospital in Mississippi, and you sit down with them and you have a good conversation. They're very happy with what you've shared with them. And so it gives you confidence. So again, you're okay. I can do that. Then in that company, I met with the board every quarter and had to present to the board every quarter. So again, not United Healthcare's board, but you know, in a smaller scale, pretty important people, and you have that conversation. And so, you know, throughout my career, I've sort of reflected on those things and said, okay, you took another step, so you don't have to go back down, right? You don't have to go back down a step. Like you can hold a conversation with a board of directors of a company. These are smart people, right? And you can hold your own. Okay, I don't have to worry about that anymore. So what's the next one? And so I've sort of used those as building blocks. Went back to Blue Cross, had to build this network. So I had to meet with state regulators, state legislators. I presented to the Mississippi State Legislature. Again, another like petrified. Do the presentation and you're like, I mean, it can't get any harder than that. I mean, these are all politicians and they all had opinions and, you know, they were all doing their political thing to make points, but you did a good job. So I can do that. And so I've tried to be conscious of those things, right? And I've looked for opportunities to stick myself in uncomfortable positions, right? After that very first one where my wife made me do it, I've looked for those opportunities because you see that you can see the development and the growth.
I want to jump in here, Mickey, so a couple things. Hopefully you've thanked your wife up and down over the years for that push. Because in essence, that shaped the trajectory of your career. And who knows where you would have been if you didn't take that, if you didn't take that interview.
I'd still be sitting in that cubicle. No, I don't think that would have been the case. They probably would have gotten rid of me after a while. But no, I thank her every day. I mean, you know, and I think that's important, right? Is even if you're not married, you need to have people in your life that are your hype man or your hype woman, right? People that believe in you and that believe you, maybe believe in you more than yourself. It's always good to have those people in your life.
The second piece takeaway, and I can now look anybody in the eye with absolute certainty and say that this is the most common theme amongst executives, is that every single person I've ever asked that question to, hey, what are the pivotal moments or why do you think you got to where you are today? Say, all say, I was willing to take risk. I got outside of my comfort zone. I took on challenge that I didn't know what the heck I was doing, but I figured it out. I gained some confidence. That created exposure, which then gave others more confidence to give me more responsibility. And here you are saying, hey, there's three different moments I can point to, at least by the snap of a finger, where I got outside my comfort zone. And then I started to do it on purpose because I knew it was good for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's a great way of summarizing it. I mean, you know, the word pumps to mind is intentional. I mean, you have to be intentional, right? But I want to step back and say, there's nothing wrong with somebody who wants to do the same job for 30 years. I have no issue. Like, the world needs people that are completely happy doing what they're doing. But if you have goals that, you know, if you want to grow in an organization or grow in an industry, then you do have to challenge yourself, right? You do have to put yourself in uncomfortable positions, not in positions you're not prepared for. Like, that, don't do anything rash. Like, you don't go to the Mississippi State Legislature and you're not ready for it. You have to be honest with yourself. But if you're ready for it, then take it, do it. Great experience. So that's the way I think about it.
So we've got to wrap up shortly, but I've got a couple other things that we absolutely have to ask you about.
Okay,
and that is, put yourself in the shoes of a director right now who's director of reimbursement, director of market access, whatever it may be, and they aspire to become a vice president. What do you think are the key differences in responsibility or mindset that maybe they're not necessarily prepared for, but they would like to be?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I've been in a lot of situations personally where you think you're ready for the next step, but the organization doesn't, or you're questioning, how do I get ready for the next step? I think the big difference is the amount of information that you have to go through and the speed at which you have to go through it to get to a decision, right? So, as you're down the organization, right, you have more time to assess the situation, the data, the facts, and come up with an idea. By the time it gets to you as a vice president, you don't have a lot of time, and you've got a lot of people asking you a lot of questions. And so you've got to be able to filter quickly and get to a decision. And the thing that I would tell people as directors, if you're presenting to executives, think about how executives want to see information, right? If they ask you what time it is, don't build the clock for them. They trust that you know how to build it. They want to know what time it is. So give them the time. And then if they have questions, be prepared to answer how you build the clock. But I think sometimes directors, when they're presenting to executives, which is how executives get an opportunity and exposure to you to see if you're ready, is they feel like they're in there justifying their opinion. They're justifying their bona fides. They're justifying, you know, everything before they get to the recommendation. And I would reverse it. You know, here's the problem. Here's what I think we should do. And here's why I think we should do it. And it might be the shortest meeting you've ever had. And people are like, that guy's smart, or that person is smart. But if you go in there and start building the clock, I mean, they're thinking about all the 10,000 other things they've got to do. So cut to the chase. I think that's how people should think about preparing to be an executive, because that's what happens. I mean, I don't have time to understand the clock. Like, I hired a bunch of really smart people to build the clock. I just need the key data points that I need to make a decision. And if I have questions, I shouldn't be, fearful that I'm going to look bad by asking questions. I'm an executive. I mean, I'm going to do that. And so people should think about it that way, right? Is think about that. Because in the end, I mean, the difference between somebody who is a very good director in an organization, who's leading strategy to some level, who's driving people to results, that next step to vice president, I have this sort of personal view that like a vice president organization is 90% future and 10% current, yeah. Right? I'm looking ahead. I'm trying to figure out the next thing about 90% of the time. A director's probably 60-40, right? They're thinking about the future a little bit and maybe 40-60. And then managers are almost day-to-day. Like, I'm thinking about today. I drive my team. So I think about it that way. And so they need to be thinking, a good director should be thinking about what's next and helping the vice president with that strategy. And that's what prepares you, I think.
That's awesome, awesome insight. I love what you said about making sure that you know your audience, not bogging them down with unnecessary detail, starting with the end in mind. Hey, here's the problem. Here's what we recommend. And then being able to field questions, because an executive will ask the questions they need to ask until they get to a level of comfort where they feel poised to sign off or make a decision. And a lot of the feedback that I've gotten over time too, with interviews and stuff, is, man, we got lost in the details, or they were either too vague, or we got lost in the details, or they aren't necessarily recognizing the audience in front of them. And you're right. Somebody with that much responsibility has so many things on their mind, and they need to think quickly and they need to react quickly. So give them the juice of what they need and kind of leave the peripheral stuff unless they ask for it. It makes a lot of sense.
And if you don't, if you start building the clock, you're not going to get to your recommendation, because there are going to be so many questions about how the clock's built, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, so I think, I tend to think, do it in reverse, the way that most people typically do it.
What makes an outstanding reimbursement or a market access professional in your mind, like a true outlier versus kind of like the run-of-the-mill pack?
I mean, somebody that's always thinking of new ways to attack the problem, right? We want to get this payer to change their policy. We're going to do this. But almost... And without fail, that's not going to work. Whatever that first strategy is not or was, is not going to work. So you need to almost build in pivot points. Like, so when that doesn't work, we're going to do this. When that doesn't work, we're going to do that. So the person who thinks that way, who has backup plans, plan B, plan C, you know, I think is better than the average reimbursement person, market access person. And then a person who is driven, right? So the worst thing that you can have on your team is someone who's like, nope, they said no. You know, they said no, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to continue. I mean, it's probably not dissimilar to salespeople in terms of the energy, right? You're going to get a lot of no's, but you got to keep fighting for some yeses. And so having that internal drive, for me personally, I don't want somebody who calls me after every failure and says, what should I do now? You know, call me and tell me it didn't work. And what do you think you're going to do? And I might throw in a different strategy, but don't come to me for all the answers, right? Yeah. Think up some on your own. So that's the kind of person. So it's sort of the intangibles, I guess. I mean, it's not a particular education necessarily. It's more that inner drive.
I was just going to say, you can't teach that. That's innate. And that's why there's awesome salespeople too, right? Who just continue to grind, are tenacious. They see the bigger why. They've got tough, callous skin, and they understand that this is just part of the game. And I think that's probably why you see so many people go on from sales to get into market access and be successful, because that's their foundation. That's who they are.
Right. I agree.
This is awesome, man. I can't thank you enough for being here. You've dropped a ton of nuggets today. What are you excited about at Serapeutics right now? What's going on?
Oh, I mean, I think we're a company that's poised to do some really good things. We've got a product on the market. It's been on the market for a number of years, continues to grow, which is nice in the orthopedic space. And then a new product with the FDA waiting on their approval. And so launching the new product is exciting. But a product that's been on the market for 6 years and continues to grow is a nice place to be. So I think there's a lot of things exciting about Serapeutics right now, but primarily those two factors.
Great stuff, man. Well, like all the other shows, if you're okay with it, what we'll do in the show notes is put a link to your LinkedIn profile and a link to Serapeutics and encourage anyone who is intrigued to reach out and learn more to do so.
That would be great. Thank you, Mitch.
All right. Well, Mickey, thanks so much for being here and for all the gold that you shared today. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening to the MedTech Talent Lab podcast. For more content-rich episodes, log on to theanthonymichaelgroup.com or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform.